How's it going, everybody? These are the worst 8 movies ever. My name is Greg Knox, and I'm joined, seemingly for the 8,000th time, it's a regular occurrence nowadays, by Miroslava Hartmund.
Hello, Greg Knox. I can't believe that I'm back reviewing a film that I famously swore I would never, ever rewatch again.
Wow. We're going to talk about it in a sec, but before we do that, I just wanted to quickly talk about a film that we watched the other day, which, again, is going to be a film that you will probably never, ever, ever want to watch again, but for different reasons.
I think I know what's coming.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So, we watch films not just for worst 8 movies ever, although this possibly could be a candidate for that in a different way. So we actually watch films.
No. That's your other podcast, show. Worst Films Ever.
Wow. There are many, many podcasts out there that are like that. Although that does sound quite a fun idea, actually. That's something I might consider. But anyway, so we talked about a film that could definitely be considered for such a show like that, which is Boxing Helena by Jennifer Chambers Lynch, the daughter of David Lynch. Not a very good film at all. It was a piece of shit.
And the film that allegedly shaped my Italian ex-boyfriend's sexuality. So I've seen it now, and wow, okay.
He's into women having their limbs cut off.
Are we talking about Boxing Helena still?
Yes, we are still talking about Boxing Helena. But that does actually bring up an interesting point. They are quite similar.
Like, yeah, Boxing Helena audition in so many
are
ways.
About people having bits of their body cut off.
Absolutely.
Although Audition doesn't have a scene where someone just wanders out into the middle of the road. They then have about 10 seconds to get out the fucking way of an oncoming car, and then they get hit in hilarious fashion by a car that only seems to hit them on their shins. I don't know. This woman didn't seem to suffer any other injuries apart from that. It was ridiculous.
Well, I can tell you Sherilyn Fenn's hair did not seem to suffer. I mean,
no,
at one point she had
her
lost.
Her makeup did not suffer either.
At one point she had lost all four of her limbs and she was still looking as ravishing as ever.
In all her early 90s Twin Peaks glory.
Mind you, I have told you this before. As far as Twin Peaks leading ladies spin-off films are concerned, I still think that Angel's Dance with Cheryl Lee is the best one. It's such an empowering story of a self-confessed female necrophiliac who finds a new meaning in life by becoming a contract killer.
As you do, it's happened to us all over time. I can't remember Angel's Dance. It was better than Boxing Helena, though, I'm sure. I know we watched it. It was a long time ago. Though I'm sure Angel's Dance did not have the amazing acting talent of Julian Sands in there as well, making
that's very true.
Funny faces, well, and all that kind of stuff.
I recently
very weird film.
I recently rewatched Ken Russell's Gothic, where he famously plays Percy Shelley, and I think Julian Sands is amazing. You know, in that film, very well cast. His sort of emphatic ways are very appropriate to conveying the moods of the great romantic Apollonian poet Percy Shelley.
Right.
But then it just does not seem at all appropriate to his part in Boxing Helena, which includes one of the most horrifying sex scenes in cinematic history set to an entire Enigma track. I really honestly think since the age of internet pornography, that kind of filmmaking has just completely lost its purpose.
Yeah, that was all you had to get yourself off to in the early 90s. Just sort of this. Once you've seen kind of one softcore sex scene, you've seen them all, basically. It was, pretty mental. I know what you mean. some pretty horrifying sex scenes. Although it's interesting that I've mentioned Boxing Helena, because Boxing Helena and Audition, like we've already said, not that dissimilar from one another. So it'd be interesting to kind of compare them when we talk about Audition, which is what the fine listeners actually came onto the show to actually do today. So myself and Miroslava are going to be talking about Audition on the episode today. It is a disturbing film in some ways. So if you're not into disturbing content, first of all, why are you listening to Worst Date Movies Ever? Of course. But second of all, and this is sort of more important, spoilers, 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 spoilers everywhere, as per usual. So yeah, just be mindful of those. So without further ado, are you ready, Miro?
I'm absolutely strapped in and ready.
Strapped in indeed. Let's get strapped on and start the show. Audition was directed by Takashi Miike and it came out in 1999. Now, Miro, from what I understand, you haven't actually seen any Takashi Miike films apart from Audition, is that right?
I have not.
Cool. So, he's actually directed, according to IMDb, 113 films, which is, as you can imagine, quite a lot. It's not as much as Jess Franco. Jess Franco directed about 200. So Takashi Miike is a bit lazy in comparison to to Jess Franco. But it's still a lot nonetheless. Now, fortunately, he's not directed the same type of film over and over again. He's made several different types of films. He's mostly known for like his gangster films. He's known for making horror films, although interestingly, when he made Audition, he had not made a horror film before. He's also made things like kids' films, which is weird. You can't imagine the director of Itchy the Killer in Audition making a kids' film, but he has. So anyway, he's made fuckloads of films, is more the point. And Audition is the most well-known, although he's also directed things like the aforementioned Itchy the Killer, Dead or Alive, Graveyard of Honor, Gozu, which is a film that I really like. He's directed stuff like Visitor Q, which is another very bad date movie, incidentally. If you're going to watch a bad date movie directed by Takashi Miike that's not Audition or Itchy the Killer, that's one to go for because it's a very messed up film. And more recently, he's made stuff like sort of samurai films, like sort of traditional kind of Japanese samurai type films. His most kind of well-known film that he's made recently is a film called 13 Assassins, which is quite fun. It's very gory, as a lot of Miike's films are. But yeah, so of those, Miro, which would you say is the most kind of interested that you would be in watching?
Well, he cited Akira Kurosawa amongst his cinematic influences, so I think it's quite a logical extension, you know, that he has made films in the samurai genre. He also claimed that his favorite film ever is Starship Troopers. So I think it gives you an idea of the sort of twisted, perverse sense of fun that runs through his work. Now, I have only seen Audition, but I've heard of it, Itchy the Killer, for years, and it's I think it was the kind of extreme film par excellence when I was in my teens. So I would be quite interested in watching that at some point.
Yeah, Itchy the Killer and Audition are his two most well-known films. After that, you've got 13 Assassins, like I said. if I was going to recommend kind of some films to watch, Audition is kind of his most well-known film. It's also probably his best film, I would say, of the ones that I've seen. Itchy the Killer is an obvious kind of second one. To be honest, if you like weird shit, Gozu is actually a fun one to watch. A lot of Miike's films, they have like a Lynchian vibe to them, and that's certainly one of them. It also features a character, the same actor of whom appears in this film as an old man in a wheelchair who's very creepy, as a kind of mob boss who enjoys having ladles stuck up him in a place where you're not meant to put ladles, let's put it that way.
Hi, Dad.
Well, your dad listens. Oh yeah, your dad does listen. I am
very proud to say
he?
That yeah. We can count my father, who incidentally lives in Wallington, as does your father, to our listeners. He messaged me the other day saying he listened to Cargo 200 and Come and See, and sent me links to some reviews that he did of a Polish film that I mentioned, Battle of Warsaw 1920. Actually, our opinions converged, I'm happy to say. And yeah, I'm just like a little bit conscious of the fact that he's listening now. So
okay,
there we go.
That's fine. I won't mention Visitor Q then, which features sort of incest and lactation and... all kinds of like fun stuff. It's actually a fun film. It's not as horrible as that sounds, believe me. It's actually quite a fun film. Miike, his films are known for, although when you've had like over 100 films, they're not all obviously like this, but they're generally known for being quite violent. They're known for being a little bit weird in places, and they're known for having somewhat of a slapsticky sense of humor. Now, I'm not a big fan of the Japanese sense of humor. Their comedies are not funny to me at all, generally, like particularly some sort of Japanese sort of horror comedies that I've watched, they just fall a bit flat on me. I don't know if that's like just a cultural difference. Like the same with Italian comedies.
Sounds like quite a niche thing.
Yeah, like there's when me and Tom Cannon reviewed the ABCs of Death, one of the short films was essentially about, it was a Japanese short film, and it featured sort of, the plot was essentially about women farting.
Which, oh yeah, that sounds that completely within, you know, that cultural paradigm.
Yeah. Yeah, so Japanese sense of humor not great, everybody. And that does sort of slightly carry over to Audition, but not too much, and we'll go into that kind of when we talk about the film itself. So, Miro, what is the story of Audition?
Well, Audition, the film, is based on a novel of the same name from 1997 by Ryu Murakami, so the other Murakami, the nasty one, not the sentimental one. And the story is actually very simple and almost deceptively simple. You know, if you haven't seen the film and you just hear the story, you don't quite get a sense of foreboding. It's about a widower in his early 40s, Aoyama. He is a representative of Japan's hippie generation. So he's quite naive, a little sentimental. He lost his wife to cancer 7 years prior. And he has a teenage son, and his son suggests to him that he should remarry. So Aoyama considers this and meets one of his closest friends for a drink. And this is a man called Yoshikawa, who's more of a kind of man of the world, you know, a bit of a sly industry type. He's in the film industry, and he hears Aoyama's predicament and says, "Listen, I have an idea. Why don't we call an audition for the role, you know, for the so-called role of your wife?" And at first, Aoyama is reluctant, but Yoshikawa assures him that if they set this up as a legitimate film project, in fact, citing a documentary that Aoyama had made with a German TV company a few years ago, they could actually get away with it. So they start getting thousands of CVs from young women, And one of the applications really strikes Aoyama's fancy. This is a young woman called Asami Yamazaki, whose short essay, where she talks about breaking her hip at age 18 and being unable to pursue a professional career as a ballet dancer, really touches something in him. And the sequence that's, I think, the most lighthearted in the whole film is where they actually audition different women. It's a nice sort of collage of the audition scenes. But Aoyama can't be bothered. He only has eyes for one girl. He's waiting to meet this one girl. And then what happens is he goes on a series of dates with her, and she seems sweet and innocent enough. And as he is falling more and more in love with her, and he is overjoyed that his plan went off so brilliantly, it turns out that he may have bitten off more than he can chew.
Mm.
And after a romantic weekend at a country retreat, Asami disappears. And the rest of the film follows Aoyama as he tries to retrace her footsteps and find her.
Mm.
Until the climactic final, and I hope this is not a spoiler, torture scene, where Asami returns.
Mm. Now, this film, as you mentioned, it's based on a story by Murakami. You've read the book, haven't you? Tell us what the major differences are between the book and the film, because there's always a lot of differences in this. Even in films where the screenwriter is the author, they tend to change scenes or they leave stuff out, all that kind of stuff. So what are the major differences between the book and the film?
I would say that the two are very similar. A lot of the dialogue is transferred verbatim into the script of the film. There are some differences. One of the differences is that in the film, there is a female character, a co-worker of Aoyama's, a subordinate, so a woman who works in his company, who is in love with him. The sentiment is unrequited. He did sleep with her once, but then showed zero interest in her, which seems to have affected her very badly. In the book, it is said that although Aoyama never dated or had any sort of, you know, romantic or emotional relationship since his wife's death, he did have a habit of frequenting sort of clubs and brothels in Tokyo, but the relationship was expressly sexual. So what he is looking for in this audition is wife material, someone that he really connects with on an emotional, on a spiritual level, as well as someone, you know, beautiful. So, you know, that's one difference. Another difference is that in the film, the climactic, you know, sort of the showdown, the madness, the complete sort of descent into madness is a sort of a surrealistic passage of horrors, you know, when different sort of scenes and visions and reminiscences follow one another towards the end of the film, when Aoyama is driven crazy by the extreme pain that he's been subjected to as Asami is torturing him. I would say in the novel, one of the most climactic and one of the most difficult scenes is the sex scene. So in the film, there is no sex scene. We don't actually see them having sex, but in the novel, it's the climax, pardon the pun, to which, you know, the story the story sort of builds up in any way. And I just wanted to read a few sentences. I mean, it's considerable. It's, you know, it's one of the most detailed and involved single scenes in the films. But, you know, just a few ideas. The last of the sunlight was slowly bleeding over the floor at his feet, and now she was standing in the semi-darkness between the twin beds, undressing. And then later, her touch was like a gleaming scalpel slicing open his breast. And then again, like the miraculous gentle touch of a healer. So this duality, you know, is she a saint? Is she a monster? This is something that comes up a lot. And then my favorite, when she'd stripped him of his pants and shorts, her eyes seemed to lose focus and her lips parted to reveal the somewhat pointed tip of her tongue. It was as if a pink thorn were sprouting from her face. So this really reminded me of kind of the Giger-esque world of Alien, you know, sort of almost like Species, you know, something, a creature that is sublimely beautiful, but also predatory, dangerous. You know, there's this kind of very visceral language. And quite an interesting thing is that Takashi Miike, instead of showing us, you know, the act between them, what he does is he sort of hints at this quality through, you know, the set design, you know, the kind of that they are shown on a bed, and the bed has these sort of spindly, long kind of metal, almost Art Nouveau bits on it, you know, and it's kind of quite Giger-esque. It kind of almost reminded me of the Alien universe in a way. But because we don't actually see Asami in any state of undress, really, in the film, it kind of maintains her mystique.
Yeah.
She remains sort of quite mysterious and in a way quote unquote virginal to us until almost the very end.
Yeah, yeah, true.
And lastly, and this is something that, you know, I think is quite significant. In the book, there are several references to the Edo period in Japanese history, which, as we know, was a period that lasted from the early 17th to the mid 19th century until the Meiji Restoration. And it was a period where when the economy, politics, society, and culture really, really flourished. And one of the things that it's best known for is the visual culture. So Hokusai, author of the really, really famous painting of the wave. It's in fact one of our emojis. So Mount Fuji seen below a wave at Kanagawa, you know, one of the most iconic images ever produced, comes from that period. And also geisha culture really flourished in the pleasure quarters of Edo or Tokyo. And there are all these allusions, you know, to this world, to this sort of mysterious world of forbidden pleasures, of women, of supernatural beauty and abilities. The film, although there is no mention, explicit mention of that period in the film alludes to it visually. And in fact, I showed you a few paintings by Hokusai, which seem to actually hint at scenes from the film. You know, when Aoyama is fishing with his son, I mean, the feminine waves, Menami picture, you know, when we are shown the kind of choppy waves of the sea, which is a sort of visual metaphor for the great unknown kind of feminine force. There's also the wonderful dream of the fisherman's wife image, which kind of set a high standard for tentacle porn in Japanese culture for subsequent centuries. Yeah, yeah. So it's very much that kind of realm of geishas and ghosts and stories and dark erotic pleasures that is alluded to visually in the film.
Cool. I was going to ask, because I've not read the book, but there are a couple of differences that I was aware of from listening to a director's commentary on the film. One of which is that Asami in the film is not made out to be this stunningly sort of beautiful woman, even though the actress who plays her, Eihi Shina, it was a model before she was in Audition. Audition was her first film role. Whereas in the book, she's a lot more kind of strikingly beautiful.
So in the book, sort of the book is very much told through Aoyama's eyes, and he finds her strikingly beautiful. He's very in love with her, and everybody else, all the other characters, are really on edge about her. They're really on edge, and they say that, yes, she's beautiful. Well. Yeah, but they, you know, they explicitly say, yes, she's very beautiful, but it's a certain kind of beauty.
Be careful, she might be a nutter.
Well, she is in this case. So there is a sense that this is not a conventional beauty, you know, it's a kind of strange, sort of haunted, almost supernatural beauty. And I think that's sort of conveyed in the film. I mean, it's difficult not to agree that the lead actress is strikingly attractive. In fact, I did ask you if you found her attractive, and you said that yes, you did.
Yeah, yes, you know, yes, I did. Although Takashi Miike,
do you still?
I was going to say Takashi Miike. Interestingly, apparently, I haven't read this anywhere. This is just, again, something that came up on this commentary. Thinks that Sheena has an unusual face.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I think, I mean, that would make sense in the context of the book as well. I'd say, you know, another thing is the most sort of disturbing scenes in the film, which, as I said, you know, is a sort of like really surrealistic circus of horrors, the visions, you know, those are, I mean, very few of them are in the book. Another thing that's not in the book is, in the book, Aoyama does not go to Shimada Ballet School. He does not go to the Stonefish Bar in Ginza. The first time I watched the film, the scene that stayed with me the most, far more than the torture scene and limbs getting lopped off by wire saws and all of that, the one that really stayed with me is when Aoyama is going down the staircase, which leads to the stone fish, which has sort of like a dirty mail under the door crack. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and one of the guys that lives in the building says, oh, well, you know, it's closed. And, you know, it talks about how the owner was killed. And he sort of says, this bit really like messed me up. He says, the floor's tilted because the building was built 28 years ago and the blood poured out into the landing. And when the police sort of cleaned everything up, they found three extra fingers, an extra ear and tongue. And Aoyama like briefly actually has a hallucination, like he actually sees that come to life. And I thought that was the most messed up thing ever. It's just something about this like claustrophobic, dirty, run down, almost seedy kind of atmosphere of this sort of staircase. It was just really hellish. And that's not in the book. So I think
that's very Miike, I would say, because Miike does have a lot of, to me, Tsukamoto is sort of the Japanese David Cronenberg. I mean, mm-hmm. Tetsuo the Iron Man is a very, well, fuck, I mean, Cronenberg could have directed that in theory. Yeah. Whereas Miike, he does have a lot of kind of body horror elements in his films, like with his violence, it's against the body.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about sort of the three fingers, the tongue and the ear, yeah, that's, again, very kind of body horror as well. Also, from the book, and it's not necessarily made as kind of clear in the film, is the whole wire cutting off people's feet aspect, which only really comes up near the end in the film. Apparently, it's more like it's happened to different men previously in the book, or something along those lines.
Well, the book chronicles, I guess, in greater detail, the history of abuse that Asami suffered. And we see this in the film, but in the book she talks about how her father died when she was very young. Her mother was an alcoholic. She was sent to live with her uncle and his wife. His uncle's wife abused her, first and foremost. It's quite significant that in the book, one of the abusers is a woman and one of the abusers is a man. So Actually, I think she does mention this in the film. Well, anyway, she's abused by her uncle's wife. Then she gets sent to live with her mother because of that. Her mother had remarried and her stepfather is disabled. So I think, I mean, he was in some way maimed or something. And so he abuses her sexually as well as, you know, sexually as physically, I guess. You know, he sort of abuses her in different ways. And he sort of encourages her to dance and masturbates as he's sort of watching her do her sort of ballet steps, which is, and incidentally, like, she develops this kind of, you know, messed up sort of bond. So whenever she becomes close with another man and they sort of, she says, you know, betray her or lie to her, she sort of lops off their feet so that they resemble her maimed stepfather. I mean, there's something to be said for it, you know. There are quite a few kind of violent sort of phallic symbols. I mean, quite famously, the huge hypodermic needle on the syringe that Asami is holding in the, like, really famous shot where she's sort of looking over her shoulder. And then, you know, so the needles, but also the red hot incense sticks that her stepfather burns her thighs with, they appear quite a lot. So there is this, suggestion of sexual violence, of violence against the body, of violence that men inflict on women, and that then, you know, women, you know, avenge their abuse by inflicting violence on men using these kind of long pointy objects. But in the film, obviously, you know, it's very visual. It's in some ways Freudian, and in this sense, you know, the Lynchian influence is, you know, it's very much there. But it's also in some ways more explicit in the film than it is in the book.
Yeah, which it would be, because that's kind of more Miike's style.
And
so as a
another thing that happens in the book is she lops off two paws of Aoyama's son's doggy, who is called Gangster in the book, which I thought was so endearing. But they give him a more sensible name in the film. Yeah, so, you know, there's sort of violence against animals, which Miike does not go in for in the film. I mean, you could see that she killed the dog, but, you know, there's no kind of protracted mutilation of the dog, which is kind of made a bit of a fanfare of in the book.
Which I was one of the things that, it's one of the only things I should say that I didn't really like about the film, is where you actually see the dead dog. I thought it was unnecessary. I thought it was pretty obvious that the dog was dead, because, well, we know she's in the house, and we see the dog dying off. You know, as horror film fans, anytime that there's a dog on screen, you probably know that dog is not going to survive till the end of the film. It's just kind of the way that things go. So,
well, it depends on the genre.
I didn't think that was necessary.
It could become, you know, rabid and possessed. A nice doggy turns into an evil demon.
It could be like Independence Day. The dog could survive and kind of jump out of a burning building or whatever the fuck happened in Independence Day as well. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. It does depend on the genre, but, you know, we're kind of far enough in the film to know that, okay, we're in horror film territory. There's a dog. Pets don't tend to survive. See, Fatal Attraction.
Oh, goodness. Kind of we're back in a erotic thriller territory. I hope this doesn't preempt your next question. But, like, I think one of the big debates was, is Audition a feminist film or not? And I think actually the way Asami treats the dog, I mean, both in the book and the film, but in particular in the book, it just does not endear her to the reader or the viewer. She's not, you know, sort of, I mean, another example would be like Kill Bill, you know, the main character, you know, the Avenging Bride. It's just a film, you know, that's very stylized, like very influenced by Japanese kind of visual culture. And, you know, it just seems pertinent to this, you know, she's kind of this kind of badass, blue-eyed, blonde, sort of almost, you know, like superhero character. Yes, she bleeds. Yes, she suffers. But actually, you know, it's all kind of for a noble cause. You know, it's very clear, like, who the villains are and who the heroine is. In this film, I would say that it shows, like, there are no winners, you know? Again, it sort of, it shows, ultimately, misunderstanding between the sexes. It shows, in a way, like, the tradition of the subjugation of women in a very hierarchical, patriarchal society, you know, that is Japanese culture. It shows that there are these sort of pockets within that culture where women can exert influence. And one way that they can do it is by sort of harnessing their beauty, you know, and sort of like duping and seducing men and making them sort of feel powerful rather than kind of expressing their like full spectrum of intelligence and ability. And ultimately, it's sort of, it's a film, I think, where there are no winners. Everybody loses something. I mean, the story starts with the loss of Ryoko Aoyama's wife to cancer. You know, it's already sort of a story of loss and wounding. And yeah, it's, I don't feel like any of the violence or any of the deception is ultimately justified. I don't feel like it's making a moral point other than that humans are lonely and increasingly more anxious and increasingly more enslaved by consumerism and kind of base lusts. And thus, you know, they become crueler and meaner and more sort of, and less human in a way.
Yeah, so I agree with a lot of what you've said there. I mean, to me, like you said, basically, I was going to ask the question, so you've kind of preempted me there. But there's two ways you can read the film. You can either read it as that Asami is this like avenging angel character, in the same way, like, because there's an interesting shot choice. There's sort of two famous sequences in this film. There's obviously the torture sequence, but there's also the sequence where she's waiting for Aoyama to call her, and she's just sat in her apartment, literally not doing anything, this giant bag in the background. And one of the shots when he does call is of the, you know, sort of stereotypical of this period sort of Japanese woman with long black hair covering her face, you know, kind of like The Ring or The Grudge, like all those kind of films. And Audition is actually lumped in with those films as well, I think slightly unfairly, because although it was made off the back of the success of Ringu, it's its own beast. In fact, very interestingly, Takashi Miike does not consider this to be a horror film. And I think the reason for that is because in Japanese society, horror films are considered to be ghost films, whereas this does not have a ghost in it, so therefore he doesn't consider it to be a horror film. But yeah, anyway,
oh, so interesting. You've got sort of... But it's sort of, in a way, it sort of does have a ghost in it, you know? The ghost of the wife appears. I mean, the wife appears in these dreams that Aoyama has, which are the, in dreams that Aoyama has, you know, warning dreams. And the sequences, you know, they're very ghostly.
Like, hallucinations and premonitions.
Absolutely. And actually that reminded me, it reminded me of a Hokusai, artwork, A Woman Ghost Appeared from a Well. I mean, this is something that I remember from a set of
Ringu.
Very Ringu. And it's possible even that, you know, the, I mean, I think Ringu is based on a folk tale, isn't it? On a Japanese, folk tale. Yeah. So this is from a set of prints that, we have, at home that I remember looking at as a child. So actually reading the book conjured these images in my mind. And reading the book, I kept thinking, this is a ghost story. And in fact, Asami vanishes, you know. So after, you know, after their intercourse at the country hotel, she vanishes and she does not appear again until she kind of turns up in her sort of demonic guise. And all the while, sort of, Aoyama is really reluctant to even, you know, hold her hand in the taxi. You know, he's super reluctant. He has this, like, feeling like, you know, if I touch her, she will vanish, almost like a ghost, you know? So it's, you know, I can kind of, like, completely appreciate Takashi Miike not reading it in that kind of, I think, archetypal way. But to me, it felt like a ghost story reading it, and it felt like a ghost story watching it. So I think it's fair to class it as a horror film.
It was deliberately made kind of by the production company, almost because Miike hadn't made any horror films up to this point. Like, so in the 90s, he was sort of mostly known for making these sort of violent gangster movies. So it was kind of hiring someone against type. And the screenwriter, so Murakami did not write the screenplay for this film. It was written by Daisuke Tengan, who, although his name doesn't actually suggest this, he is the son of a famous Japanese director, Shohei Imamura, Mark Cousins' favorite. Miike actually had worked with Imamura as well, so he knew Imamura quite well. So you've got sort of two very key sort of members of the production there who are not known for kind of making horror films. And in a lot of ways, this is not a stereotypical horror film. One of the things I would say about this film is, as is quite obvious from sort of the way that people kind of interpret the film on a surface level, is that it's a very slow burn. Not a lot happens for the first 45 minutes. It's kind of, like I said, more of a drama, even comedic. Like, the audition scene itself is sort of very kind of played almost for laughs in a kind of way. It's sort of very light and fluffy. The music is sort of very like dee 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 dee, like that. I don't know why I chose that, but
that's wonderful. Yeah, anyway, I think it conveys the mood perfectly. It's weird though, you know, because I remember watching it the first time and actually chuckling, you know, watching the audition, you know, collage. But the second time I was watching it, it suddenly appeared like really seedy and sinister and horrible to me, you know, because I sort of had already experienced the entirety of the movie. So I think on second viewing, it does appear as a much more kind of seamless, well-constructed overall work, you know, where you can kind of already, you already know where their foreshadowing is. You kind of, you know, the kind of critical scenes that you're going to sort of tense up for and endure, but then the whole thing sort of is one, you know, it's one entire creation. Whereas the first time watching it, I felt like the moods, the shifts of mood, they were not gradual, they were very abrupt. You know, we went from like really kind of moving, let's say, sort of sentimental, to like super prosaic, to almost sort of comedy, to then sort of romantic, to then like increasingly more kind of haunted and horrified, to then like complete madness, you know? Mm. So it really does, it really uses quite a broad palette of moods, I would say. You can't say that a mood is sustained.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with that. Because, yeah, the first 45 minutes or so, it has sort of one kind of feel, and then it kind of slightly shifts into slight surrealism from the scene, the very famous jump scare with the bag, which is a properly done jump scare, by the way. So jump scares isn't something that I've talked about very much in this series, because the type of films that I cover, they're not really jump scary films as such. But the jump scare in this is actually really well done, because you don't see it coming, because of the use of depth of field, because you've got Asami in the foreground, shallow focus. Again, Mark Cousins-isms on the show now. So we've got shallow focus in the foreground, and you've got the bag, which is out of focus because it's in the background, and then the bag suddenly moves, and then it becomes sort of, yeah, the sort of center point of the shot. So, so that's sort of done really well. And then it becomes slightly, yeah, a little bit kind of unhinged. And then, like you said, from the point that she disappears, that's when the film starts to then become a lot more frenetic, and it becomes a lot more sort of typically Miike inspired. Because what I would say about this film is that it's very kind of un-Miike in a lot of ways. One of the things you can say about Miike is that his films are pretty mental, or at least his most well-known films are kind of mental in a lot of ways. They're not necessarily known for their restraint. This film, for the first half of it anyway, it's incredibly restrained. Like, it doesn't start getting weird and kind of typical kind of Miike territory until you get to where Aoyama is exploring Asami's kind of background, and you've got, you know, weird men in wheelchairs, you've got people having their fingers cut off and all this kind of stuff. You know, you've got Asami vomiting into a bowl, and this man who's been kept captive in the bag kind of drinking the vomit and all that kind of stuff. That's more kind of typically sort of Miike and stuff like that. Even the big torture scene, which we're going to talk about later, that's very restrained. People think of this as is this horrible set piece, and it's really not, but I don't want to go into too much detail there. Going back to what, because I kind of caught myself in my own kind of, you know, ramble there, talking about kind of, is the film misogynist, is it feminist or not? I don't think the film is misogynistic personally. I mean, you could read it in one sense of, okay, Japanese culture, very patriarchal. It's very kind of heavily favoured towards men. Look at a lot of the sort of, you know, Japanese films from like the 80s and the 90s, even the 2000s, sort of female characters aren't given a lot of prominence. There's a lot of films where there is a lot of violence against women, sexually and kind of non-sexually, particularly in stuff like Pinky films and like exploitation films and things like that. So you could see the film as a reading of that, but I never thought of it in that way. I thought of it as, you know, Aoyama, his wife's died, right? He's not moved on as such. And although the audition itself is set up in a very kind of like, you know, it's a bit of a sleazy thing to do, I guess, in hindsight, is setting up this fake audition, you know, to meet a woman. It's not like he went for about four or five of these women and slept with them before he found this one woman. It's like he found the one woman. He wanted this one woman. He kind of was sort of loyal to her as such the whole time. And then obviously things happened. And yeah, obviously he had an affair. Well, not really an affair. He did have a sexual, you know, short sexual relationship with his secretary. Is it his secretary or his underling, subordinate?
Underling.
Was a term used earlier. Yeah, at his film company. You know, so it's not like he's totally innocent. But unlike something like Hostel, and I mention Hostel very, very specifically, because as I mentioned in my review for Hostel, Miike appeared in a cameo scene in Hostel because Eli Roth watched Audition at film festivals before he made Hostel. And he was like, oh, I like this. It's a slow burn horror film and it's got lots of torture at the end. I'm going to take that idea, but he's going to do it completely wrong, which is basically what Hostel is.
Mm.
But anyway, have you seen Hostel, by the way?
I have not. And
okay.
It's not on my immediate watch list.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, I think the way the characterization is masterfully done, I think, in the novel and the film, is that Aoyama is like really average. Like, he's not a villain. He's not a hero. He does some things well. He tries to be a good father. You know, he tries to be present and caring with his son and has, you know, a good relationship. And in many ways, the son is the voice of reason in the book and in some ways the film. But at the same time, you know, he does do things that are sort of quite morally reprehensible. It depends on how low you want to set the bar, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I kind of attribute that more to his associate, his colleague, who sets up the audition itself, Yoshikawa. Interestingly, slight factoid here. So the actor who plays Yoshikawa, Jun Kunimura, actually appears in Kill Bill as well. So you mentioned Kill Bill. There's a slight sort of connection there.
Oh, very cool.
But so, yeah, I always laid that more on sort of Yoshikawa. Like, Yoshikawa had the idea to set up this audition, and he's kind of, I don't know, from watching it, he seems to be getting kind of more out of it than Aoyama is. Aoyama doesn't really seem to be that interested in any of the other women. He's kind of just waiting for, like, Asami, you know. So, I don't know, that's how I read it.
Yeah, for sure. He's not, he doesn't seem to be kind of getting as much voyeuristic pleasure out of it as his friend. But you have to remember that Yoshikawa does this for a living. You know, he is, as he says, a professional auditionist. So, you know. Right. As far as ulterior motives go, making someone your wife may or may not be the worst reason, to set up a fake quote-unquote audition. But that there is something about kind of deception and, you know, the hunt. The fishing scene at the start of the film is quite significant because it's made a bit of a fanfare of, not only by referencing several famous Hokusai paintings that I mentioned earlier, but also because the fish that Aoyama catches is a big female fish. And, the son comments on the fact that they saw its ovaries and stuff like that, you know, so it's sort of very much, the big man catching a fish, but then the hunter becomes the hunted as the tables turn and the big, beautiful female fish, Asami, turns out to be a predator of a wholly different class and repertoire.
Calling her a fish.
Well, did you notice that the bar where she supposedly worked but actually killed is called the Stonefish? It's certainly like there's a little Peskin metaphor that runs through this.
Cool. No, I see where you're coming from there. So, haven't really talked about kind of the film itself in terms of sort of what I thought about it from like a filmmaking perspective. So, I think this film is very, very well directed. So, as you've already mentioned, for Miike standards, it's quite restrained. So, not... A lot of people sort of say, oh, this film's really boring. It's not. Okay, if you know someone like that, give them a slap from me, because it's not boring. What it does, and this is, again, another thing that Eli Roth kind of failed to do with Hostel, is he saw, like, okay, I'm going to tell a story, and I'm going to have nothing happen for, like, the first kind of 30 minutes of my film. But this film is a lot more character-driven, I would say, than a lot of horror films. So you get to know, you know, Aoyama, and then you get to know kind of Asami, and the film is kind of very light. It sort of almost resembles a drama, but then as it goes into sort of the scene, sort of from an hour onwards where she has apparently disappeared, and then you've got sort of the hallucination scenes and things like that, the film style is very different. So one of the things during these hallucination scenes is the use of sort of colored lighting. During the hallucination scenes, you've got red light, you've got blue light, you've got yellow light in this sort of old kind of ballet studio and things like that. Really, really like that. The use of kind of weird camera angles, sort of as the film got more and more insane, shall we say. And you already mentioned sort of the sort of more handheld kind of style. So there's a scene where Asami goes missing, Aoyama goes back to the film studio to talk to Yoshikawa, and Yoshikawa's like, no, what are you doing? This girl's clearly mental, sort of leave her alone. And that whole scene is very handheld. There's a cool sort of tracking shot that follows Aoyama as he's walking through the studio. And what they do, which was not something that you would probably notice, is, you know, in editing, there's a rule, I think it's called like the 90 degree rule, where you're not meant to kind of move the perspective of shots. When you move back and forth, it does that. Which, again, you probably wouldn't notice most of the time. Well, I fucking didn't, because I never noticed things like that until you point them out to me. But, like, so it did things like that, and I thought that was very interesting. So, yeah, this is a very, very well-shot film, which is weird, because Miike, considering he makes loads of films, he's actually not someone who's traditionally thought of as someone who's a great stylist, you know, like certain directors are. That's not a knock at anyone. But I think in this film, he shows, you know, a great deal of style and restraint and things like that. And I thought that was very good.
And this apparently took 3 weeks shooting to his normal 1 week shoot.
Wow. Really taking his time. He's those 3 weeks.
In and out like a ninja.
Dude. dear.
It seems curious that Audition came out seemingly at the right time. Like, it was coasting on that J-horror wave, but also it was well received on the festival circuit, you know, as a kind of art house, you know, foreign language sort of drama horror. I wonder how it would be received if it were released today. I find that even though we tend to think of Audition as a film that can be interpreted as a feminist, you know, text, I think if it were released today, it's more likely that it would be criticized for being misogynistic, you know, both for the concept and, you know, for the portrayal of the female lead.
I mean, that happened at the time anyway, so I don't think it would be that dramatically different. It's interesting you bring up festivals, because when it was released at the Rotterdam Film Festival, it won like an audience award. I think it won a critics award as well. And it also had, in a similar way to something like Irreversible, which we talked about before,
walkouts.
it had walkouts, and people, you know, apparently there was a story that came up in a director's commentary that Mieke was at this you know, showing of the film, and apparently this Dutch woman came up to him and said, "Are you sick? And like, how can you like make a film, you know, with this content in it?" And getting very, very upset with him. And someone had to translate to him what this woman had said and things like that. So yeah, making friends in Rotterdam, as you say.
Well, it's just as well that Mieke didn't show the dog having both front paws cut off with a wire. So,
oh God. I think there would have been riots if he'd done that.
For sure.
But, I mean, look, everyone kind of knows that the main kind of thing that happens in Audition is sort of the main torture set piece, which takes place, I would say, sort of an hour and a half into the film. So you've had sort of this slow burn, film kind of goes along for an hour, and then it starts getting weird, and it starts getting very, very weird in that sort of Mieke fashion. And then you go to sort of the torture set piece, where you've got Ayama. He drinks whiskey. It's foreshadowed a few times in the film that, you know, whiskey is quite important. It gets drugged, and then he gets paralyzed, and then he gets various things done to him. So he gets his tongue injected with, I'm assuming, sort of a paralyzing agent, so he can't talk. That's actually quite an interesting thing.
Or move. I thought.
Or move. Yes, very true. And then he gets these like long acupuncture needles put into his body. Now, I've had acupuncture done to me. The needles didn't hurt. I can't say I touched them while they were in me, but the act of putting them into my body did not hurt. So these must be very specifically painful.
Well, she explains that. She says she's going to inject him with something that's going to make him immobile, but that's going to make his nerves extremely sensitive to pain.
Yes, which, okay. I suppose when you put it like that, it does sort of make a bit more sense.
Plus,
yeah, absolutely.
I don't know what kind of acupuncture you had, because I've had acupuncture over the years as well, but I don't think they were putting needles underneath your eyeballs.
No, that didn't happen to me either, no. Unless I kind of repressed that part of the acupuncture process. No, they did not do that, no. And then, as well as that, you've got his foot being cut off, or at least one of his feet being cut off with the wire as well. Now, what I would say about the set piece overall, what makes it different from, let's say, Hostel, because fuck it, I'm picking on Hostel today.
This season, not just today.
Well, yeah, this whole season is just an excuse for me to rag on Hostel for 11 episodes. Yeah, you're right. So what Mieke does, and this is very un-Mieke like in a lot of ways, but what Eli Roth did not learn from this set piece, which he should have done, is number one, it has no score in it. There's no sort of non-diegetic music on the soundtrack. It happens in kind of total silence. All you hear is her voice and the things that she's doing, and his screams of pain, or sort of muffled screams of pain. So that's number one. Number two, because he's paralyzed, he can't shout. So he just kind of has to sort of lie there and take it for the most part. So when you've got sort of people in these sort of torture porn films, you know, it can get a bit monotonous after a while where it's like, why are you doing this to me? Stop. No. Ah, and all that kind of stuff.
I think watching this stuff has changed you irreversibly.
Very true, very true. Gaspar Noé made that film about me in my the desensitization process of watching these films, what it does to a man. So as well as that, you've got her voice. She is very calm. She is very almost jovial to be carrying out this torture. You've got the ki-ki-ki-ki-ki.
Which means deeper, like deeper, girlish. Deeper, deeper.
It's the only time in the film where she's actually really enjoying herself. What she's doing is where she's sort of, you know, playfully putting in these sort of acupuncture needles into his body. Also, it takes its time. So there's parts of it where instead of it being kind of cut, 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 there's a long kind of, I would say, 30-second long shot where she takes out this, I don't know if it's like a sheet, and she lays it on the ground. She puts his body on the sheet.
No, it's a sack. It's a sack like the one that we saw in the jump scare scene.
Right. See, I don't pay attention to these films properly, clearly. Yeah, okay, that makes a bit more sense.
So
is it clearer in the book?
No, I noticed it the first time. You know, that's the idea, that he is becoming another one of her victims. We've already seen what she's capable of. And now, you know, this is happening to him.
Okay, well, as well as that, sort of as she's going about her work, the camera is just stationary for a lot of it, and it just observes her doing it, takes its time. Also, very key, it's not actually as gory as you think it is. So the things that happen, i.e. kind of, you know, the injection into the tongue, the needles, even having the foot cut off, it's not in itself really gory. I mean, there's a little bit of gore when it comes to the foot being cut off, but it's more her face as she's doing it, his reactions, and the sound of the wire going back and forth as she's cutting. That's what makes it really scary. It's the imagination that we have as we're watching the set piece that makes it. Even when she cuts the foot off and she throws the foot at the window for some reason.
With such glee. Like, she does it with such relish. I think that's, you know, like one of the most disturbing things about it.
No, and I mean, yeah, even though it leaves like this bloody mark on the window, that's sort of, I think, kind of black comedy, really, more than anything else. It's not sort of awful. Also, as has been pointed out again in the DVD commentary as I was watching it, she's wearing an apron as she's sort of doing all this. One of Miike's favourite films is The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So it's meant to be like a visual kind of nod to that, which I thought was quite interesting. So your thoughts on this. Do you agree with what I'm saying? It's so good. And also, it's the only sort of set piece like that in the film itself. So it stands out as opposed to seeing one person getting tied up and tortured and a second person being tied up and tortured and then screaming for, you know, minutes at a time, relentlessly. And all
I haven't ever seen any of the Saw films or the Hostel films, or, you know, it's just not my thing. So I don't really. I have seen,
in terms of this,
The Devil's Rejects, which apparently was also influenced by it, in part. It's very well orchestrated, for sure. It is the climactic scene to which everything is building up. But what I find particularly clever about it is that the torture scene is broken up with these crazy, like, visions, you know, these visuals, these sort of like surrealistic horror visuals. So as Aoyama passes in and out, you know, comes in and out of consciousness through the extreme pain, he, you know, goes on these kind of journeys, you know, beyond the physical. So, you know, that's something that really amplified it for me. If it were just a sort of, you know, almost semi-documentary scene of her just very meticulously torturing him with like no non-diegetic sound, I don't think it would have had the same impact for me personally.
No, and there are films that are like that, and it's very matter-of-factly.
Well, when you're seeing it, I'm thinking done that way. The Golden Glove is a bit like that. The Fatih Akin yes. film. Certainly no bells and whistles there. It's very it's realist with a capital R, isn't it? It's really sort of
yeah. And you've got Funny difficult. Games, which has got a lot of that kind of stuff in it.
Well, I was also thinking of American Psycho, also because it was another sort of controversial adaptation of a very violent book. I remember reading the book as a teenager shortly after watching the film for the first time and being sort of, quite keen to see where the book allegedly went further than the film. And it really did. It really did.
Mm, yeah, no hamster scene in the film, believe it or not.
Yeah, that's really awful.
It's very awful. So in terms of Audition, though, going back to that film, this is, I guess, now we've talked about sort of that part of the film, I guess the most appropriate place to ask, Audition, how bad is it? This is the part of the show where we're going to discuss how bad a date movie Audition is in terms of, is it a good date movie? Is it not that bad? Is it bad? Is it very bad? Or is it the worst? I will go first this time. Because give Mara a little chance to ponder my question. I would say this is a bad date movie, certainly not good, but I wouldn't say it's very bad. So reason for that is that while the violence in the film is very violent and it's notorious for good reason, I would say, similar to kind of other films that I've talked about, it's not as violent, literally, as sort of other films. So it's probably a more psychological film than a straight-up gore film would be. So while I wouldn't recommend it to watch on a date at all, I mean, you're going to give your date ideas, possibly, while they're watching it, I would say it's not a horrible film. It's a really good film. It's a very, very well-made film. It's something that you could probably watch and have a conversation about afterwards, you know, if that's the kind of thing you're into, about gender politics in the same way that myself and Miro have on the show today. And yeah, it's violent, but it's not gratuitously violent. It's not horribly violent. And yeah, I would, yeah, that's my opinion on that. So Miro, what's yours?
Well, since it's the, you know, excoriation of sexual politics, I think it's a very bad date movie. I reiterate, I think you have been affected and jaded. You're constantly comparing terribly gruesome and heart-wrenching films to other films which are even more violent and even more gruesome.
Yes, I am. That's my frame of reference.
I think you've lost your objectivity. I think that, I mean, actually, like, imagine, right, that you are actually looking for a suitable film to watch with someone that you are beginning to date. Now, they might be into film, you know, but they might not be at this level. How bad a choice would that be?
I'm obviously not suggesting you actually watch Audition on a date.
But
if you did, then there are worse choices that you could make. You could watch Irreversible, for example, or Cannibal Holocaust, or the Vomit Gore trilogy.
I still haven't seen Cannibal Holocaust. I still feel like the first time I watch it, and the only time I watch it probably, just has to be with you. I feel like it's one of those we have to be in the same room together.
Lads, I've got a date sorted out.
I think it's a very bad date movie. I think that it's physically taxing. I think that it leaves a bitter taste in the mouth and frankly makes me want to rock gently and quietly in a darkened room for at least 20 minutes after, you know, the curtain falls. And the most disturbing...
I did make you watch it twice.
I felt like it was a worthwhile thing to do. It truly is a work of art. And, you know, having read the book and rewatched the film in one day, I really, you know, got a really concentrated kick from it. And, you know, I would say that, like, one of the most horrible things in the film is that pop song that plays when the credits roll is just
It's terrible.
It's just some horrible Japanese pop hit, you know, which then I think the chorus is like a woman with a really nasal voice. And then like the chorus is in English, but it takes you a while to realize that it's English because she's singing in this like really thick Japanese accent. It's got to be heard to be, you know, really believed. But
also, you know, it's a really massive juxtaposition as well, because we've just seen this man get tortured for about 12 minutes. We've seen this woman kind of, you know, get kicked down the stairs, you know, this horrible situation where this man now is missing a foot, shall we say. And, you know, he's like still, you know, his wife's still dead. His son's alive, thank God. You know, his dog's dead, all this kind of stuff. And suddenly, like, this woman who he was really into is now also dead, and also a total psychopath who tried to kill him and potentially kidnap him as well. And then it's really happy during the credits. It's like, okay.
But it's like one of those like super intense ones, you know, when it's like, no, 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 no. And it's like really synthetic. It's, you know, that's one of the many reasons where this is a very bad date movie. That fucking song, you know.
I pose an alternative theory.
Okay.
I actually think this could work as a sort of Netflix and chill style situation. You could be with someone who, as I mentioned, the film is a slow burn, and by about 20 minutes in, they're going to get bored. I know of someone who you know as well, who their significant other had a similar response to that, where they were like, oh, this film audition is meant to be really good, but I thought it was really boring. So what you could do is you could be with someone that's like, well, they're not going to be in the mood for this. They're going to, you know, get bored after about 10 or 15 minutes, and then I'm going to get some action. So, you know, it reverses.
Exactly, when does almost boredom lead to arousal? I mean, this is a dynamic. I mean, I have to be, I don't know, I have to be stimulated in one way in order for that to transfer into.
Yeah, you, I don't know. There's I don't personally agree with this, so please don't come for me, everybody. But there is this train of thought with this stuff where it's like, if you're bringing someone back and you want to get in the mood, you don't put on something that's A, good, and two, that's going to sort of turn them off. So what you want to do is you want to put on something that's all right, a little bit boring, or something that's going to sort of, you know, get them sort of, you know, in the mood. So something like, I don't know, The English Patient, for example, might be a good date movie, because that film is very boring. So your date would be like, right, no, had enough of this, let's go on with it. I don't know. Audition could be a similar thing. I'm not suggesting it is, because I really like Audition. I actually think it's one of the very few actually genuinely really good horror films from the 90s. And it just about scrapes in the 90s as well, because it's 99. So I don't think that, but I don't know. My point is that you could get away with it.
So I feel like every time that we host a show together, we get closer and closer to the crux of your definition of a good date movie. So getting some action, quote unquote.
That's not my definition of a good date movie. I don't know. A good date movie to me would be like, I don't know, a Pixar movie, or some, I don't know, like a movie that's not going to ruffle any feathers, where you're going to have a grand old time.
It depends on whom you're dating.
Yeah, this is also true as well. I also made this very clear, like when I started doing this show, that like, look, for most people, right, Irreversible is going to be a terrible date movie, or Requiem for a Dream would be a terrible date movie. But if I was on a date with someone and they wanted to watch Requiem for a Dream, I'd be like, yeah, fuck it, this is a great idea.
Well, so, my dad says that it's a great concept. He loves the concept, Greg.
Well, thank you, Andre. He's got Andre's seal of approval, and that's what matters the most.
Absolutely. He's also sent me some ideas for bad date movies that we could do. So, cool. You know, we're getting some input.
Awesome. Cool. So on the whole, just to wrap the show up, really like Audition, very well directed film, very well paced film. It's kind of stylish in the second half of the film when it needs to be stylish. It's got some sort of typical Mike elements, and it's got the weirdness. I like weirdness, everybody. So, you know, those sort of elements I do appreciate very much. And yeah, it's probably the Mike film that I recommend to people the most if you've never seen a Mike film before.
But then it's not like other Mike films, you say?
It's not like most Mike films, no. If you want to check out Audition, then it's available quite widely on DVD. It's currently available in the UK from Arrow, for example. It also typically appears on streaming services quite a lot. So if you're a subscriber to Shudder, I imagine it's probably on there now. I've seen it on Mubi before because it's got the art house cred as well. So yeah, it's quite easy to find if you've never seen it before. So yeah, by all means, definitely check it out. And on that note, I want to thank Miroslava Hartman once again. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me on the show, Greg Knox.
That's all right, Miroslava Hartman. So on the next show, I'm not entirely sure what film I'm going to be doing yet, but I'm pretty sure you guys are going to really, really enjoy it. I've got another show coming up with Miro in this series. I'm not going to spoil what film it is that we're going to be doing, but I think you guys are going to like it. It's quite a notorious film. Back to the 2000s again. It's in the art house vein. It came out in 2009. It involves a fox in quite a pivotal scene. Should probably give away what film it is now. That's not all it's known for, but it does have a fox in it. And yeah, on that note, I don't think I can do any better than that. I will see you on the next show. Bye, everyone. Thank you for listening. If you want to follow me on social media, you can at Worst 8 Movies Ever. And don't forget to click subscribe wherever you're listening to this right now to never miss another episode of Worst 8 Movies Ever.